warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds, while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster, that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Purizam, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity. For example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide 18 billion euro to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A draft law aiming to punish anyone caught wearing a full face covering has been proposed in Switzerland. If passed, Muslim women caught wearing a niqab or a burqa could be fined up to $1,000. A far-right proposal to totally ban facial coverings in public has already become law, winning a narrow victory in a referendum in 2021.
The ban was pushed by the Swiss People's Party, with one of its parliamentarians arguing that the ban would promote equality between men and women and would also help to fight back against so-called Islamic radicalization.
Muslim organizations have expressed concern over rising Islamophobia in Switzerland and condemned the move as hypocritical.
So the Swiss cabinet says that this general ban on face covering is about the safety and safeguarding of citizens. But why not make an exemption for the niqab? I mean, it's not like there's a crime spree of niqabis across the country. That's just ridiculous. And, you know, jokes aside, what is going on here with vilifying a well-known symbol of the Muslim faith is that Muslims would then, as a community, be seen as divisive and criminally minded if we so much as speak up in support of the niqab.
Laws which negatively affect Muslim women are springing up across Europe. France banned wearing full-face veils in public in 2011, whilst Denmark, Austria, the Netherlands and Bulgaria have full or partial bans on wearing face coverings. Muslims make up only around 5% of the Swiss population. Yet, how Muslim women choose to dress remains a major obsession of right-wing lawmakers. Robert Carter, London.
Another Palestinian young man, seen by many as a hero and an icon, has been killed by Israeli forces during a confrontation in the occupied West Bank. For more than 10 days, the regime's forces had been carrying out a manhunt for Uday Tamimi after he shot at an Israeli military checkpoint at the entrance to his hometown, the Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds. On Wednesday night, he was gunned down during clashes with Israeli forces at the entrance of an illegal settlement in eastern Al-Quds called Ma'ale Adumim. Hearing a call from Palestinian factions, a general strike has been held in Al-Quds. and throughout the occupied West Bank to mourn at Tamimi. The walkout affected all public institutions and private sectors, including schools and businesses. Public transportation was also shut down during the strike.
The general strike prevailing today in the occupied territories is a political message that the Palestinian people are standing behind the resistance option and to assert that they are following the footprints of the martyrs until victory and freedom. It's a message that the Palestinian people will not stand with their hands cuffed in front of the Israeli crimes and that they have the right to resist the occupiers.
Palestinian resistance factions have also urged Palestinians to take to the streets to denounce At-Tamimi's killing and the aggression by the Israeli regime. Sporadic protests also erupted in several areas of the West Bank. Protesters said they would offer as many martyrs for the sake of Palestine's freedom while fighting the Israeli occupation. They added that more action is required to respond to Israeli atrocities.
We are united as Palestinian people. We continue to prove that we have strength to sacrifice our souls. We are ready to go to direct confrontations to resist the Israeli forces. We stand united behind the resistance, behind the confrontations, behind the martyrs.
Israel's escalating repression during the last month is part of a larger operation to quell the growing Palestinian resistance, particularly armed resistance. Recently, many Palestinian youths are drawn to this kind of resistance, with the newly formed group of fighters known as the Lion's Den as an example. Many might question whether a new uprising against Israel is in the making here in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. While the Israeli military is escalating its crackdown against Palestinians and using excessive force to counter the Palestinian resistance, it's obvious that Tel Aviv fears a renewed surge in anti-Israeli operations, especially after a rise in armed attacks against the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, Occupied Al-Bira.
Britain has been thrown into another leadership crisis after outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss announced her resignation after just 44 days in office. Her departure makes Truss the shortest-serving UK Prime Minister in British history and the fourth Tory to head the troubled nation in just 4 years.
I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
So now eyes turn towards who her successor will be. The ruling Conservative Party have chosen to ignore opposition calls for a general election.
This cannot continue. Britain deserves better. Britain cannot afford the chaos of the Conservatives anymore. We need a general election now.
The next Prime Minister is expected to be elected via another internal leadership race within the space of just 1 week. Speculation suggests that past leadership contenders Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt both have their eye on the top job. Whilst current Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has ruled himself out of the race, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has stunned many with rumours he may attempt a return. Truss's allies claim she stood aside graciously. However, critics believe she should be held accountable for her self-admitted mistakes.
Liz Truss leaving after just 44 days in power really epitomises the state of the current Conservative Party. Because think about it, if after 12 years of power, yet another Conservative Prime Minister is chased out after being unable to clean up the mess that their party created, well, what does it say about any other potential leadership candidate?
Going forward, it's expected things are going to move very rapidly, with Tory MPs expected to put forward their nominations on Monday, with an election process concluded by Friday the 28th, and with a new Prime Minister in place in time for October the 31st's fiscal statement. However, it's surely going to take much more than a speedy election process to restore the nation's lost confidence in the ruling Conservative Party. Robert Carter, London.
Thank you. Iran's foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, has paid a visit to EB House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EB Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%. Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The charter airline that was hired by the British government to remove asylum seekers to Rwanda has pulled out of the scheme following a wave of public pressure in Britain. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. A charter airline hired to remove people seeking refuge in the United Kingdom to Rwanda has pulled out of the scheme after pressure from campaigners. A plane operated by Privilege Style first attempted to fly asylum seekers to the East African country in June, but was grounded by an 11th-hour ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. The Mallorca-based carrier had become known as the UK government's airline of the last resort for its willingness to conduct deportation flights that other airlines refused. But after an email campaign by torture survivors and refugee organisations, Privilege Style has said it will no longer operate flights to Rwanda. The development will leave the British government in a fix. Two other charter airlines that previously conducted deportation flights, Titan Airways and Air Tanker, have already ruled themselves out of the scheme. In a letter to the charity Freedom from Torture, which has led the campaign under the hashtag #StopTheFlights, Privilege Star said it hereby wishes to communicate the following, that it will not operate flights to Rwanda in the future, that it has never flown to Rwanda since the one flight scheduled for June of 2022, which is the reason for this controversy, was suspended. The United Kingdom signed a £120 million deal with the Rwandan government back in April to outsource the UK's asylum system as it sought to find a solution to a growing number of refugees entering the United Kingdom via small boats in the English Channel. The deal meant people who had arrived in the United Kingdom by irregular means, such as by small boat, could be forced onto a charter plane and flown to the East African country of Rwanda. It was criticised by human rights organisations because of Rwanda's record as an authoritarian state that repeatedly imprisons, tortures and murders alleged political opponents. Privilege Style's statement followed an escalation in public protests against it by campaigners. Last week, activists from Freedom from Torture presented the firm with Worst Airline of the Year award at the carrier's headquarters in Palma, Mallorca, in front of the media. According to the carrier, its VIP customers include several Spanish companies and top Spanish football clubs. Campaigners targeted Privilege Style outside the Real Madrid versus Barcelona football match last week in Madrid, holding banners reading, "Don't fly with Privilege Style while they profit from refugees' pain." No flights have taken off yet to Rwanda because of legal challenges in the High Court. On 14th of June, a Privilege Style Boeing 767 was due to take seven asylum seekers to Kigali in Rwanda from a military airport at Boscombe Down in Wiltshire. The day before, it had taken tourists from Tenerife, Spain, to Dusseldorf in Germany. But the flight, which cost the British taxpayer about £500,000, was cancelled at the last minute following a decision by the European Court of Human Rights. Liz Truss, the outgoing British Prime Minister, had pledged to continue the scheme. Candidates considering running to be Prime Minister, including Rishi Sunak, Penny Mordaunt and Boris Johnson, are expected to support the deportations. The British newspaper The Daily Mail also has details about the same story. An airline hired by the British government to deport migrants from the United Kingdom to Rwanda has pulled out of the scheme following controversy surrounding it and backlash from human rights campaigners. Privilege Style was due to remove people to Rwanda in June for the first time under the government's new immigration policy. But the flight was grounded at the last minute after intervention by the European Court of Human Rights. The Mallorca-based airline had faced calls and public demonstrations urging it to abandon the arrangement and today confirmed it would not put on any more flights to Rwanda. and a major blow to the British government's policy, the airline has now described the controversy surrounding the episode and pledged to never attempt to fly migrants to Rwanda again. In a statement, the operator said, "It's important for us to clarify that we will never operate the flight to Rwanda since the one scheduled in June of 2022. The reason for this controversy was suspended and never flew. That we don't operate flights to Rwanda in the future." Freedom from Torture, which led the campaign, said it had received a letter from the airline detailing the decision, in which it also asked the charity to now cease actions against our brand. Kolbasia Hasu, who fled torture in Central Africa and now works for the charity, described the news as a victory for people power after activists stood up against the British government's cruel Cash for Humans Rwanda scheme. With Privilege Style pulling out, the wheels are coming off the British government's dodgy Rwanda deal. Whoever succeeds Liz Truss as Prime Minister should put an end to this inhumane plan once and for all, he added. Last week, activists stood outside Privilege Airlines headquarters in Palma de Mallorca with a banner reading Worst Airline Award Winner in both Spanish and English. The withdrawal of the operator, which became known as the government's airline of the last resort, has prompted questions over which airline could be used to operate the government flights should they go ahead. Two other charter airlines that previously conducted deportation flights, Titan Airways and Air Tanker, have already ruled themselves out of the scheme. The Home Office said it does not comment on operational matters, but that the government remained committed to the Rwanda policy. The then Home Secretary Priti Patel announced the £120 million deportation deal back in April in a bid to curb channel crossings by people in small boats. Since then, at least 32,300 have made the journey. The legality of the arrangement has been contested in the courts of law, with ministers and campaigners awaiting a ruling from High Court judges on the case. The first flight in June was halted following an 11th-hour intervention by the European Court of Human Rights. The plans has also faced condemnation from public figures, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welsby, who said, "Deporting asylum seekers should shame us as a nation." The outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss had vowed to stand by the plan, as did Rishi Sunak and other candidates who ran to become Conservative Party leader over the summer. So far this year, more than 37,500 migrants have arrived in the United Kingdom after crossing the Channel, according to government figures. This includes over 4,500 this month alone. But the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, has not recorded any arrivals in the UK since Tuesday amid poor weather conditions at sea. A Home Office spokesperson said, "We remain committed to our world-leading migration partnership with Rwanda, which will see those who come to the United Kingdom through dangerous, illegal and unnecessary routes relocated to Rwanda to rebuild their lives in that country."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
UK's political drama is nothing short than a soap opera. A country that will have five prime ministers in 5 years
one that has also had four finance ministers or chancellors of the exchequer just this year. Why is there so many resignations and uncertainty in that country, especially at a time when the UK is dealing with the cost of living crisis? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at where the UK is headed to and whether it can climb out of this political deadlock. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Political economy researcher and analyst Clive Menzies joins us from London. Also joining us is journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Clive Menzies, and ask you about basically what are we looking at when it comes to the UK? I mean, you know, I mentioned the stat, five prime ministers in 5 years, and you have four finance ministers or chancellors of the exchequers that have come and gone just this year. What does this say about the UK?
Well, I think what it says about the UK is something more general, which is to do with who is actually driving what is happening in the UK and elsewhere. And essentially, if you look at the machinations over the last few months, we've been predicting an economic collapse, a global economic collapse for some years now. And we were anticipating that October was going to be quite a critical month. And I think that Liz Truss's appointment was something of a hospital pass insofar as she was destined to fail in terms of trying to cope with the situation. And furthermore, anyone else who takes that position will be similarly afflicted by the bigger picture, which is essentially driven by the money markets and money power. And so whoever they put in place is similarly going to be facing huge difficulties because there is no fiscal or monetary ammunition left in the armory to deal with what is taking place. They've already created huge amounts of money printing, the banking system in the UK, Europe, and in the USA. And governments are being discredited because they have been complicit in this fiasco that has brought us to this position.
When you take a look at the country on the economic front, that is one thing for our Hughes, but when you take a look at the turnover, as they say, I mean, that's quite astonishing. And when Liz Truss resigned, it just days ago, she was in Parliament saying, I'm a fighter. It just seemed so abrupt. What do you think might lead to her resigning in the form and manner that she did, given the short period of time that she was in that position?
I'm not sure she was given an awful lot of choice. I believe it's the 1922 committee that carries a lot of weight and a lot of influence within the parliamentary party of the Conservatives. And I think just with her, the budget that she brought in and the flight of finance from the UK and the strengthening of the dollar and the weakening of the pound, I think that the people who have the influence in the background just told her it was time to go. I don't think she had much of a choice. You know, under the circumstances, she might have been able to call for a vote of confidence in her leadership, but I'm sure that the sounding she took in the background among her own MPs and close party colleagues would have told her that that support wasn't there. I mean, she threw her chancellor, her choice, underneath the bus, so in order to try and save herself and save her skin. But it wasn't enough. It was too little, too late. And I think we're witnessing like a car crash politics. You know, it's a circus now where they're just, you're waiting for the music to start and everyone to play past the parcel. And, you know, the last one to sit down becomes the next prime minister.
You've caught my attention there, Clive Menzies, when you say that decisions are being made from not within or from the outside, in a sense, as if I heard you correctly. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because, for example, when it came to Hunt receiving word that Liz Truss was actually wanting him to take over the job as the exchequer, he thought that it was a joke, that it was not even something that was authentic.
Well, I think it was fair to say that if you look at the background of her appointment, there was a fair amount of, shall we say, hedge fund money that was interested in her appointment, and they profited highly out of what she did. The collapse of the pound they made money out of. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily the case that these things happen of her own volition. If you look back, all of any prime minister who resigns always to the last minute says that they're fighting and they will stay on until they're eventually ejected. And I think that the forces that are at work are much clearer today than they may have been in the past. And money is the banking system, and those that control money are very much in control of the agenda overall. But I would say that no one is driving the bus now. It is just the collapse. Your other guest referred to a car crash. I see it more as a slow motion train crash that started in the financial crisis of 2008. And it is now accelerating, and nobody is in control of this bus. And the politicians, to some extent, are the fall guys in this episode because they will be blamed. But it is actually a structural problem which is far deeper than politics can cope with.
Well, you have a party by the name of the Conservative Friends of Israel, Frau Hughes. And it was interesting when she was running for the premiership, she made a vow, or a pledge, I should say, that not only would she, during one of those conferences that was held by the CFI, that she would definitely reevaluate first, she said, on moving the UK embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds, and then to review the trade deal between the UK and Israel, of which it was up for reevaluation. She said, you know, we can do much better trade and much more trade and an expanded amount of trade volume with Israel. And she got elected, she was moving on that track, which was quite interesting for that to be on top of her list. And some deducted that she had made pledges to some of the wealthy within Israel that, hey, come invest in our country, improve our economy. And, of course, we know that she was really holding the trickle-down economics at the center of that piece. But that didn't guarantee her her staying on. What do you think went wrong there? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Yes. No, I think it's a case of what your other contributors said. It's the money in the background. You know, there should be some type. I know there's supposedly a cap on how much you spent in elections, and there has to be tax returns in order to give everyone an even chance of being elected. But I think there's definitely an Israeli lobby. There's definitely money involved in the corruption of politics, if I could use that particular phrase. And I think what we have is her pledge to Israel was, I am a true friend of Israel, just like Donald Trump declared before he became elected the president in the United States. And Barack Obama, before that, he went to the Wailing Wall and put on the prayer cap and a prayer shawl and almost gave deference to Israel over the over his own American constitution. So I think they helped get her elected. There will obviously be friends of Israel within the Conservative Party. They probably would have garnered all those votes to help get her elected. But let's just say now that she's gone and it looks like Rishi Sunak is probably the most likely person to be not elected, but to be chosen to replace her by the Conservative Parliamentary Party. He is the man that the elected MPs want to lead the party. And Boris Johnson may be the man who the Conservative membership would like to elect. But I read there recently that there were questions raised about Rishi Sunak's wife's connection with InfoSystems, whose headquarters, I believe, are in Israel, and they have close connections to the Israeli intelligence service. So you might have a change of prime minister, but unfortunately you will not have a change of policy when it comes to defending Israel, and God forbid that he might continue with her plans to move the embassy to Al-Quds.
Sure. Clive Menzies, so what are your thoughts on this Conservative Party's future? I mean, at this point, you would think that, you know, they have had this grip on power, and they were able to do that by learning, obviously, all their mistakes through their leadership throughout the years. But that didn't transpire the way it has. Do you think that the future of the party is in jeopardy? That's something people are saying, and I'm not too sure what that quite means. First of all, if you agree with it, and what does that exactly mean?
Well, I think there's a wider question about the discrediting of national politics. I think one's seeing it in America as well as in the UK and in Europe too, that actually the caliber of politician has been slowly declining in terms of their intellectual ability. Not that I think that anything has changed significantly, other than there appears to be an overall plan, because if you look at this in the context of the Great Reset, where there are plans to create a one-world government, one of the essential prerequisites of that is to destroy the identity of the nation-state, and part of that is to discredit politics. I think there are a number of possibilities that lie ahead, either that another patsy or pigeon will be parachuted into place and they will be similarly discredited in a fairly short space of time. Or we could actually see a national government being formed. But let's not forget that Keir Starmer is a member of the Trilateral Commission. And referring to the power that, or sway that Israel has over British politics, that applies to both parties. And I think you're at it. Other guests was spot on, that irrespective of the flavour of the rhetoric or the flavour of politics that appears superficially or cosmetically, the agenda continues irrespective. Most of what we're seeing is theatre, and the real agenda continues almost unabated.
Well, there's got to be at some point some kind of, I'm sure, voting that needs to take place, not within the party to choose the next leader, but a democratic vote that needs to take place. At this point, Fahiz, don't you think that people there in the UK have lost trust in, I don't want to say democracy, but in the system of governance in order for them to come out and vote for one party or the other?
Well, speaking personally, I no longer vote. I believe that by voting these people in, we do give them a mandate. But, you know, when they're in opposition, they are populist and they say what people want to hear, and also claim to bring in policies that people need in order to, you know, fight against the rising cost of living and the energy hikes, et cetera, et cetera. But once they get into power, they universally seem to just let us down and continue with the same poker game that we're witnessing at the minute. So should people have a general election? Absolutely, but the Tories aren't going to hold one because they know they will be decimated if they go in front of the electorate. It is not just the debacle of the economy. I mean, anyone in their right mind is not in favour of this war continuing in Ukraine. And when people like Boris Johnson and then Liz Truss get up in the House of Commons, and Boris actually went on more than one occasion, I believe, to Kiev to show his solidarity and support, they're encouraging a continuation of a war that it appears that Ukraine cannot win. So they're just wasting human lives, civilian and military, for the sake of, some people are saying, the midterm elections in America. So the Tories won't have an election. And even if there was one, even if the people demanded one, and they then changed the Tory parties for Keir Starmer's Labour Party, it's new Labour, and I don't see any real difference between them and the incumbent Conservative Party in power at the minute. And Keir Starmer was actually the man who prosecuted Julian Assange. So if there's no justice for Julian Assange, there'll be no justice for the people of the United Kingdom if Keir Starmer is elected.
Yeah, indeed. That's a fact that many forget. So, Clive Menzies, if we want to take a look at what has occurred regarding this post, the Prime Minister post, I mean, as I mentioned, you got three leaders that sought to basically get the Brexit done. Of course, what happened with Cameron and the, what he called for the vote for that. And, you know, they have not been able to do it. Is it the fact that the problem lied in Brexit itself, that should not have happened? Or is it the fact that the leaders could not get Brexit done?
Well, I think Brexit is something of an illusion, because whilst all the things that inconvenience ordinary people, travel and freedom to do business in Europe and all of those things, Brexit is an illusion. There has been no exit. Militarily, we're more closely tied in with Europe, legally, financially, and almost in every respect that matters. We are tied into Europe and still following European directives, even though they may not be acknowledged as such. So I think Brexit, if you go back to 2016, there was when the vote happened, there was growing realization that the major problem was the power of money. And it was very definitely the 99% against the 1%, or in fact, I would argue much smaller than 1%. And what both the election of Trump in 2016 and the Brexit vote did was split the 99% down the middle. And that has been a trick that has been played for centuries, that you divide the electorate, in order to carry on with the agenda that has been in place. And if we look at the prospective candidates, Rishi Sunak, for example, not only is he tied into Israel, but he, like a number of other leading conservatives from past administrations, are very much tied into the banking system. And the banking system is not comprised of individual banks and central banks. They're all controlled by the same few families. And so this is, as I said earlier, this is the theatre that goes on. Brexit is similarly theatre, because there has never been an intention to provide true autonomy or independence. And if we're not following EU directives, we're following UN directives. There is an overarching agenda to concentrate power effectively in a one-world government. And the EU was merely a conduit for that. And whether they do it via national governments directly or whether they do it via regional accumulation, such as the EU, is not really important. The agenda continues irrespective. But the good news is that it's becoming very apparent that the wheels are falling off the bus, and there are a growing number of people who are disaffected with politics, they're disaffected with the system, and they're creating their own systems for health, for food production and distribution, and this will only grow because people are realizing that they can place no trust in authority to look after their interests.
I'm trying to really absorb what you just said there. Thank you for that. And Frahis, let me get a reaction from you, because our guest there said that's good news, that basically not going with the establishment and what they're advocating, and for people to create their own independence through whatever routes that at the end of the day brings them some kind of financial stability or income is the way to go. What do you think?
I think there's definitely a place for that. But what's in my mind, so long as the system is in place, it doesn't matter who's elected into that system. I've always viewed it as, you know, the people who say, the reformists who say, vote for me or vote for our party or vote for us, put us in government and we'll carry forward the policies that are going to bring real wealth distribution among the people. But what happens is they go into the system, then they become part of the system, and eventually they defend the system. And 20 years after they've gone into politics, they become the very people that they first stood outside of Parliament, shouting that these people must go. So unless there's a change of system, then systematically nothing will change. People, I believe, are beginning to awaken to the fact that we are being constantly lied to, constantly misled, and are constantly brainwashed by the mainstream media of government propaganda. And I don't have an agenda. I have no axe to grind here. I just see that as one of the biggest kind of blockades and stumbling blocks to any form of real democracy, because we don't live in a democracy. We live in a duopoly between the two major parties. There is no real third party. There's none in America. There's none in Britain. I don't think there's many in Europe. Trump got elected because he was the anti-establishment guy, and it shows that there is a voting base for people who want the system to change. But the system's been there for hundreds of years, and you know the only way for it to be changed is through some form of social revolution. And what that would, what means that would take, I'm not 100% sure. But I promise you, those in power, and more importantly, those behind the throne, those behind the power, those with the money and the influence, they would soon have the police and the army on the streets, restoring order and beating their citizens.
Well, when you talk about a social revolution, Clive Menzies, our guest there, mentioned that, and you, Clive, talked about how the good news is that people should establish their own way. It comes at a time when you're looking at a very unstable world altogether, and you're particularly with energy prices to have led to this high state of inflation, which for the UK is at the highest in 40 years. Do you still think that the establishment, therefore, should be done away with or not be there? Because, again, it comes at a very sensitive time.
Well, in terms of energy, this has very little to do with the sanctions on Putin and has much more to do with the green agenda and the policies. And as far as the policies that are derived from that fraudulent science that says that the climate is being caused by us, climate change. But we won't get into that. I would say that we're ruled by a kakistocracy. There's a Danish researcher who explained this in 2015, which is effectively rule by the worst. And when we talk about revolution, I think the last thing we want is uprising on the streets. But there are other factors. When one talks about police or martial law, let's not forget the police have families and friends, and they are similarly affected. So in terms of the future and as regards inflation, the inflation is largely a product of overprinting of currency. In terms of what is going to happen in terms of social revolution, it is basically the fragmenting of institutional hierarchy, where people will turn their backs on authority, be it local government, national government, regional government, and they will turn their backs on the large corporations that merely predate on them and create their own networks. How long this will take is difficult to say, but there is undoubtedly a seismic shift in the way humans are going to conduct their affairs, and I think we're at a pivotal point where the system or the structure is beginning to dissolve because it no longer has credibility.
Okay, thank you so much. We'll leave it there. That's Clive Menzies from London, political economy researcher and analyst. Also, thank you, Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitali.